Is your underwear in need of a refresh? Meet Tomboy X, makers of the original boxer briefs for women, queer-founded and queer-run. Tomboy X designs sustainable, gender-inclusive underwear and apparel in sizes 3 extra small to 6 extra large. Use code IHEART at checkout for 20% off your first purchase only at TomboyX.com. Shop now on TomboyX.com.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Hi, Bechtelcast listeners. This is Jamie.
Hello. And this is Caitlin.
So we just wanted to do a quick explainer at the top of this episode. We're doing something a little different this time. We're covering Tangerine, a movie that, you know us, we have a lot of blind spots going into analyzing this movie. So we wanted to get a number of perspectives on it. So mm-hmm. You will hear not one, but three different guests today. Kai Choice mm-hmm. is with us for the majority of the episode, but we also have analyses and input from two other incredible guests, Dahlia Bell and Violet Gray. So look forward to that. And I guess it's also worth stating that we talked with Dahlia and with Violet after the recording of this original episode.
Yes. So enjoy the episode.
On the Bechdelcast, the questions asked if movies have women in them. Are all their discussions just boyfriends and husbands, or do they have individualism? The patriarchy's effing vast. Start changing it with the Bechdelcast.
Hello and welcome to the Bechdelcast. My name is Caitlin Durante.
My name is Jamie Loftus.
It's us. This is our podcast.
This is our feminist movie podcast where we lead our discussion and our analysis using the Bechdel test, which is a media test made by queer writer Alison Bechdel, sometimes called the Bechdel-Wallace test. Mm-hmm. But Caitlin, it's been a couple of weeks. What is the Bechdel test? Oh, I simply don't remember.
Gee whiz. I'll see if I can remember.
Yeah.
Now, historically, we have, and many people have used a version of the Bechdel test that...
It's funny to use the word historically in as it pertains to us,
to
a show
us,
that's been on for 4 years. Historically, though. No. Historically... I see where you're going.
Yes, with. Thank you so much. Yeah. But like with us, and then also on a larger scale, many people use the Bechdel test in terms of, do two women speak to each other? That's what we've always said. Now, in our ongoing effort to be more inclusive, we are adjusting the way we see the Bechdel test. And rather than two women or two female identifying characters speaking to each other about something other than a man, mm-hmm. the version of the test that we are going to use moving forward is two people of any marginalized gender. So that includes women, that includes non-binary people, that includes intersex people, that includes trans men, speak to each other about something other than a cis man?
Yeah, a cis man.
Yeah.
Because if there's anything we don't need more of in cinema, it's cis men.
Cis men. Right. So that is our Bechdel test moving forward.
Yes. Shall we try to make it pass?
Okay, yes.
Okay, this is a special dystopian edition of the Bechdel test. Ready? Let's run it. Hey, Caitlin.
Yes, Jamie?
I don't know why, but the National Guard just flew a drone over my house. just something terrifying to think about. And we're talking about a drone. Mm-hmm. That's an example of the Bechdel test being passed.
Yeah. That is scary. We live in a police state, and fuck the police, defund the police.
Yes, if you're pro cop, log out.
Yeah. Go do some reading.
Anyways, yes, I'm very excited for the movie that we're covering today. This has been a long time coming. We've been talking about covering this movie for a long time. But I'm glad we're doing it. We're covering Tangerine.
Yes, we are. And we have a guest with us, as always, a special guest. Mm-hmm. He is a comedian, podcaster, host of Women Who Kill podcast. It's Kai Choice.
Hello.
Hey, Kai.
How's it going?
It is. It's going.
It is. It is going.
That feels like, yeah, that feels like the right vibe.
Was that a real drone? That wasn't a bit? That actually happened to you?
No, I was on the phone with Caitlin before you jumped on the Zoom call, and it was like, it became really loud all of a sudden, and I looked out the window, and there was just a gigantic, like, low-flying drone just going over my neighborhood that I need to do some Googling about. I was like, I thought... Are they still here? Like, I don't know, but it was very close and very loud.
I've never seen one in real life.
Me either. Yeah. Shaken to my core. I mean, hopefully by the time this episode airs, I will know more, but given, who knows? Who knows?
You'll be
but
fine.
Yeah,
you'll be fine.
Keep us posted.
Yeah, I will.
Yikes.
Welcome, Kai. Well, we're excited to have you.
Yes.
Terrifying drones aside, we're happy you're here.
Yes. Like we said, we're so excited to cover Tangerine. Kai, what is your relationship with this film?
I love this movie. I saw this movie for the first time a couple years ago.
Yeah.
And the only thing that made me want to watch it was, the plot sounds crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I heard they shot it on an iPhone, and I was like, I need to see how terrible this is. And it wasn't.
Mm-mm.
It's great.
No, it's like... I think that if I didn't know that this movie was shot on an iPhone going into my first viewing, I wouldn't have guessed it.
Mm-hmm.
I would have been like, oh, it looks like a DIY movie, but I never would have guessed it was shot on an iPhone.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I would have thought they did something weird to stylize it. I'm like, no, that's just how it looks when that's what you use. But it worked. Also, two white guys produced it.
Yes.
That impressed me.
We'll talk all about that.
Yeah.
But the director of this movie is a white man named Sean Baker, and then he co-wrote it with Chris Bergog.
Well, we'll talk about that though, because I think that the writing credits of this movie are a little bit
belong to
messed up
other people. Yes.
Yes.
Why the improv or?
Yeah. Well, and we'll cover this more when we get into this discussion, but the central conflict of this movie, the whole plot, is something that the one lead actor in particular, Kitana Kiki Rodriguez, who plays Cindy, actually a few things that happen in the movie, a few pretty major plot points, or like, again, the whole story are like...
Her like lived experience.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Things that either happened to her or happened to friends of hers that she just kind of like... relayed the information to these white cis male screenwriters. And I mean, there's definitely, like I said, there's a whole discussion to be had, but
The production of this movie, I didn't know anything about other than the iPhone aspect. I didn't know much about the production of this movie, and there were a lot of twists and turns
for sure
in the production. There's a Duplass brother that gets involved. You're just like, whoa, there's
Well, Jamie, what's your relationship and history with it?
I have seen this movie before. I really, really enjoyed it. The first time I watched it, just because I think it had come to streaming recently and I just wanted to see it because everyone's like, it's the iPhone movie and it's great. And I was like, okay. And I really, really enjoyed it the first time I watched it. At the time I wasn't watching it critically, but I was excited to revisit it for the show. And guess what? I still love it. It's a really fun movie.
Same.
What about you, Caitlin?
Yeah, I saw it. It came out in 2015. Mm-hmm. I probably didn't watch it for the first time until a couple years later. I think I saw it in 2017 the first time. And I had heard similar things like, they shot the whole thing on an iPhone. Isn't that marvelous? But I'm almost kind of like, who cares about that? Like, it's such a monumental film for so many other reasons.
Yeah.
And it's so fun. It's so funny. It's, I mean, a romp. You know me. I love a good romp. But it's, yeah, I loved it. I watched it. I've seen it a few times now over the years. And big fan. Big
fan. I think it kind of selfishly it's fun because it takes place near where we all live. And so you're like, oh, I know it. Oh, cool. I think I know every location.
I've driven past Donut Time before.
Yeah.
But also there are parts where you're like, you didn't walk there. You didn't walk from there to there. Yes, there's no way.
Right?
Yes. I was like, unless we're cutting to like hours later.
Yeah.
Cool. So should we jump in?
Yeah, let's do the recap.
Cool.
So, it's Christmas Eve.
It's a Christmas movie.
In Los Angeles. It's a Christmas movie, right?
It is. Oh, this is good. This should be added to the like official holiday movie master list.
Yeah, with Die Hard.
For sure. And yeah. One of many reasons I like this movie is that it's a movie that takes place around Christmas time that treats Christmas like it's just any other day. It kind of...
Sometimes like, it's lighting. I feel like the main plot of it being Christmas is like some fun holiday lighting in some scenes, mm-hmm. which we're like, all right, cool.
But for the most part, everyone's just like, I don't really give a fuck that it's Christmas. And I'm like, that's how I feel as the resident Scrooge McGrinch of the group.
Did you just Scrooge McGrinch?
Uh-huh. Yes, that is what I said. And I'm so sorry, everybody.
Innovating all over the place.
Thank you. It's actually the name of my new screenplay, Scrooge McGrinch, the anti-Christmas story.
The Antichrist Mass story.
Yes, it stars.
Who does it star? Who does it star?
Oh, oh my gosh. Honestly, if Alfred Molina is not in this movie, I'll pitch a fit.
It's true.
So...
He belongs somewhere in this universe. I'm assuming it's an expanded universe. There's a lot, you know.
Oh,
Scrooge McGrinch,
definitely.
I need at least four movies to unpack.
You'll get them. I'm working on it. Okay, anyway, so it's Christmas Eve in Los Angeles. Ever heard of it? And we meet...
West Hollywood, specifically.
In West Hollywood, yeah. Mm. We meet Cindy, played by Kitana Kiki Rodriguez. And
you gotta spell it.
Yes. It's not the like C-I-N-D-Y spelling that you might be accustomed to.
Not the Brady spelling.
Mm-mm.
It's S-I-N hyphen D-E-E. Last name Rella.
Last name Rella. So Cindy Rella. Yes. Or is our protagonist's name.
You don't call her protagonista? Then...
I can do that.
Hell
though
yeah.
I'm not sure I will. And then she is with Alexandra, played by Maya Taylor, and they are best friends, and they are both trans sex workers. In their conversation, Alexandra lets it slip that Cindy's boyfriend and pimp, Chester, has been cheating on her with a white cis woman whose name they're not totally sure of, but they think it begins with a D. And this was happening while Cindy was gone for the past few weeks. And we found out later that she was in jail for possession of drugs that she was holding for Chester.
She was in jail for 28 days, right? That
yes.
was the day. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So she's, yeah.
This is actually the sequel to 28 Days Later.
By the way, RIP Donut Time.
I know.
Yeah. It was a simpler time.
It was a donut-ier time.
It was a donut-ier time.
Wow. You're not wrong. Okay, so Cindy sets off to find this lady.
Yeah, the fish.
The fish. Fish. Mm-hmm. And Alexandra reluctantly agrees to help her. And she's also handing out flyers for a show that Alexandra has later that night at Hamburger Mary's at 7 p.m.
Yes, this is where the walking comes in. You're just like, how did we get here so quickly?
Right. Meanwhile, we meet Razmik, a cab driver, and we see him driving some people around. He'll
now, is this before Uber? Or was it?
Ooh, good no. question. Uber was so, definitely right? a thing at this point.
It was just, was it kind of new?
Maybe like wasn't a gigantic threat to the cab industry yet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know.
Because he seemed busy.
Right, he was always driving, and it was like, yeah, I guess it would have been cab times. I also, I mean, this movie was like shot. Let me get the exact dates of when this was shot, because it might have been shot like at an even more cab time. Let me see. Okay, it was filmed at the end of 2013. So I feel like that is pretty firmly like before Uber really, really caught on, right?
It was still, it was already definitely a thing. But yeah, I don't know if like the widespread adoption of like Uber and Lyft was, it wasn't super popular yet.
Sound off
in
the comments.
But Kai, you said BU, and that provides an opportunity for me to bring up something that I hate to bring up, which is,
did you go to Mormon College?
No, that's BYU. I went to
Boston.
BU, yeah. And I did get a master's degree in screenwriting there. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. I did that on purpose.
I hate to bring it up, but you left me no choice. Okay, so we meet this cab driver, and then we cut back to Cindy. She asks Nash, played by Ian Edwards, who is a comic and actor, of course. But
he's really funny.
He's super funny, yeah.
Yeah.
She asks Nash if he has seen Chester, and he tells her to go to a food line where she might be able to get some more information from people. That leads her to Bob, who tells her to go to a particular motel. Meanwhile, Alexandra starts working. A guy picks her up. They get into a fight because he won't pay her.
Yeah, he completely shortchanges her from the jump, and then the situation escalates because
cops get involved, and because this is fiction, the cops are hella cool.
Yeah, the cops don't,
they still suck, but
they're like, it's Christmas,
right, they're like, I'm gonna let this one slide, and you're just like, okay, cop,
like, really? Yeah. Would you do that? I don't think so.
It's still fucked up.
So then we see we're back to Razmik driving around cruising. He's looking for a sex worker to pick up, and we learn that he is pretty much only interested in trans women. And then he and Alexandra cross paths because he is a regular client of hers.
Mm-hmm.
Then Cindy finally finds the woman she's looking for. Her name is Dinah. Mm-hmm. Pulls her out of this party room at this motel and starts
party
dragging
room.
Her. Party room. Excellent.
That's such a nice, that's a nice way of putting it.
Party room is so wholesome.
Right.
I know that motel, by the way.
Oh, really? No way.
Wait, where is it?
It's at Hollywood and La Brea.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Oh, yeah. I used to drive past there all the time going to Nerd Melt.
I used to work at the only real job I ever had was a nonprofit that provided services to a lot of sex workers.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone knew that motel is like legit. That's all that motel does is
they rent
by the hour to sex workers. And it was nice to see that, you know, they're still doing business. They're still doing really well. Mm. Got some full frontal male nudity.
Oh, yeah. We see at least one dick. Yeah.
It's a scared dick. It's a dick against the wall. And you're like, oh. Yeah, she finds Dinah.
She finds Dinah and pulls her out, like drags her out by her hair and starts dragging her across town toward Donut Time, where she finds out that Chester is. But then she realizes it's a little past 7 p.m. and that she's missing Alexandra's show. So Cindy drags Dinah to Hamburger Mary's to
watch on a bus.
The performance. They get on a
bus.
They
go on a city bus. You never see, that's like one small representation thing that I always really appreciate. And you never see like protagonists use public transit. Like it's, and when you actually see it, you're like, people, of course, like they're, but yeah, they hang out on a real life LA city bus. What a dream.
And everyone has seen that.
Yeah.
You know, if you've ever like taken the bus for more than a couple of days at a time, you've seen a situation like that. You're like, I'm going to pretend this isn't happening right now.
This is
none of my business. Someone is probably in danger, but.
This is a low key hostage situation. It's a hostage romp.
Mm-hmm. Everyone minded their own business. It was nice.
Yeah. We all got to where we were going.
So meanwhile, we see Razmik at home and realize that he is married. He and his wife have a small child. His mother-in-law lives with them. So we realize basically he's kind of living this double life.
They are Armenian.
Yeah. Yes, they're Armenian.
It is like there are so many elements of this movie that make it like an awesome LA movie because it's so many like underrepresented communities in LA specifically are in the, and it's like seeing an Armenian immigrant family and seeing them like actually characterized and not just like in passing is for the amount of movies that take place in LA, it's like a super rarity. It's cool.
Totally.
Mm-hmm.
So he also heads toward Alexandra's show at Hamburger Mary's. Then we see her singing at the show. And then we also see Cindy and Dinah's interactions being a little less antagonistic than they were a little bit before.
I wanted to see Dinah continue to be beaten because the only two white people in this movie are the kind of white people who use the N-word because they think it's cool.
Right.
And so anytime something bad was about to happen to them, I'm like, yes, bring it.
more
beating.
It's her and Chester.
And Chester, yeah.
Yeah.
It is wild because there is such a huge build in the movie to you meeting Chester. And then when you meet Chester, you're like...
It's not what you expect.
You're just like, this is who we were so... This guy? All right. Maybe he has a great personality. And then he doesn't.
No.
There. And then he does not. He
this is who everyone was fighting for.
Right.
I'm just literally.
Chester has no idea how good he has it.
Right? Yeah, their interactions become a little less antagonistic. They smoke. Is that crack?
They bond over meth.
Oh, it's meth.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know drugs. Embarrassing. Oh,
God. Caitlin. So, how do you live in LA and you don't know meth?
I don't know. I'm a square.
It's a cultural staple.
It's basically the main thing LA is known for. So that happens, and then Cindy also fixes Dinah's smudgy makeup, so it's like, maybe they're starting to be sort of friendly toward each other.
The makeup that she fucked up because she beat her until she cried it off?
Uh-huh, correct.
It's very sweet.
It is like that. It ends up being a very tender moment where, I love the pacing of this movie, too, where it's just like, things are like happening. It's a romp. We're going from place to place very quickly. And then every once in a while you get like to really hang somewhere. And it's not always with the characters that you expect. Like I wasn't expecting a longer scene with Cindy and
like
Dinah.
5 minutes in the bathroom.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But it just feels right. And it like gives you a chance to catch your breath and see these characters together. You're just like, damn, it's a good movie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So then they head back toward donut time to link up with Chester. Meanwhile,
we're going to talk about how terrible the show was.
It's not fair of me to gloss over that. Yes, no one shows up really to Alexandra's show, which as comedians, relatable.
We understand.
We get it.
Especially around like the holidays in LA. And if you're like still doing shows, you're just like, there's four lonely people and they're so into it. And then other than that, there's no one. And you're just like,
You know what I wish they had done? I wish that in the middle of her song, they had turned on a blender at the bar.
Someone started shaking a drink really hard. Like
Every time someone orders a fucking daiquiri.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Who's ordering a daiquiri? Who?
And whoever it is then is like heckling from the back. You're just like, God.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And then we find out that she had to basically like pay to get stage time.
Uh-huh. Also relatable. We've all been there.
I definitely have paid $5 to participate in an open mic before.
Yep. Oopsies.
But it's an audition, Caitlin.
Right. It's valuable.
You're being charged in experience. I thought Alexandra's performance was lovely. It was really sweet and really nice. And I was just, I don't know. Yeah, it's just like a holiday time show feel where you're just like, it'd be so nice if there were people here.
Okay, so they're heading back toward donut time. Meanwhile, Razmik is trying to find Cindy and Alexandra, but he missed them at Hamburger Mary's. So he asks their friends where they might be, and then he also heads toward donut time. But
he lied to his family.
He lied to his family and his mother-in-law.
He said he had to go to work.
Yes.
Right.
His mother-in-law is suspicious, so she gets in another cab and hunts him down. So then Cindy, Alexandra, and Dinah arrive at Donut Time, and Cindy confronts Chester, who we meet on screen for the first time, about cheating on her with Dinah. Chester's all like, "No, Cindy, I love you. You're my fiance." And then everyone's like, "Wait a minute, what? You're engaged?"
And Dinah is heckling the whole time.
Yes.
Right.
Yep. And then Chester eventually admits to having sex with Dinah. And just then, Razmik shows up because he wants to spend time with Cindy. But right then, his mother-in-law also shows up, and she realizes what Razmik has been getting into this whole time. So there's a lot of yelling, and then she calls her daughter, Razmik's wife, and she shows up, and then there's more yelling.
This poor woman who owns the donut shop is just like, why does this keep happening to me?
She keeps threatening to call the cops, which again would have, in real life, resulted in
everyone dying.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah.
But yes, thankfully the cops never show up.
Yeah, that's real.
I was like, classic cops.
Yeah, it's an emergency. Yeah. Okay, we'll be there in 6 hours.
But anyway, so Razmik's wife is just like, well, you know, sometimes a wife has to look the other way.
Because he is the sole breadwinner.
Breadwinner,
right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah.
She's like, why did you call me down here? I know this already. Yeah. Trying to pretend this isn't happening. Now you have to embarrass everybody.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But anyway, so it seems like everything's going to be okay after all this chaos has just erupted. But then Chester is like, wait a minute, Alexandra is the one who told you that I was cheating, Cindy? Well, did she mention that she and I had sex? And then Cindy is devastated that her best friend would betray her like that. So she storms off. Alexandra is trying to reconcile, but she's not having any of it. And then she tries to go to work, but some awful bastards throw a cup of urine on Cindy, and then Alexandra runs over and helps her get cleaned up. They go to a laundromat. She washes her off, and then she gives Cindy her hair, and then they make up, and that's the end of their night and the end of the movie.
Why is Chester the what? Why can no one do better than Chester? I don't understand. He has zero redeemable qualities.
Because you see these women like knowing their worth a lot, like throughout the whole movie, they're like, no, like you have to give me more money. Like I'm not doing that. Mm-hmm. Like there's a lot of them knowing their worth.
I feel like,
I guess not with.
Not to defend Chester, but, and I'm not defending Chester, but there's a lot of strong women who know their worth who are inevitably, like kind of inexplicably with a Chester.
Drawn to 40-year-old dudes who still have skateboards.
Right, and you're just like, okay, so there's something that, you know, like Cindy hasn't unpacked where she's, you know, everyone has I have a certain kind of shitty guy that I'm
drawn
to.
You have a Chester?
I have a Chester. It's not the Chester type, but I have my Chesters, you know, I've had my share of Chesters.
Sure.
Who among us hasn't had a Chester or two?
Yeah. Well, let's take a quick break and then we'll come right back to discuss the film.
Cool.
There's nothing worse than wearing clothes that don't fit right. That's why Tomboy X makes size and gender inclusive underwear, swimwear, and loungewear for all bodies. Queer founded and run for over 10 years, you can trust they know a thing or two about making the perfect pair. Feel comfortable in your own skin. Shop online today and use code IHEART for 20% off your first purchase. Only at TomboyX.com. Tomboy X. Fit for you just as you are.
Tired of restless nights? Meet Lisa, the sleep experts. Here at Lisa, we know that good sleep is essential for mental, physical, and emotional health. That's why their mattresses are made for exceptional comfort and support, catering to every sleep need. Check out Lisa's Sapira Hybrid Mattress, named Best Hybrid Mattress 5 years running. Sleep hot? The Chill Collection is built with cool-to-the-touch top fabric and layers of high-density comfort foams, all intended to remove excess body heat while maximizing comfort. With Lisa, getting a new mattress has never been easier. Delivery is free, and you have 100 nights to try out your mattress in the comfort of your home. Don't spend another night dreaming of better sleep. For a limited time, save up to $700 off select mattresses plus two free pillows. Go to lisa.com/iHeart for an additional $50 off mattresses and select goods. That's LEESA.com/iHeart. Exclusions apply. See lisa.com for more details.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. Well, I don't know about you, but like, I never liked being told, oh, wow, you look so good for your age. Like, why even bother saying that? Why don't you just say you look great at any age, every age? That's what Meaningful Beauty is all about. We create products that make you feel confident in your skin at the age you are now.
Meaningful Beauty, beautiful skin at every age. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
And we're back. So
where to begin? There's so much, so many wonderful things to talk about.
Does it make sense to get into some of the context in terms of like the production and development of this movie?
Sure thing.
First.
Yeah. So I think that the surprising thing for me, because again, when I was watching this movie the first time, I didn't do research on the director. I was just watching it to enjoy it. But the director and one of the two credited writers on this movie is a director, Sean Baker, who is like a white guy who went to NYU, which I don't know what I was expecting, but I wasn't expecting a white guy who went to NYU. And so I think that that is like, that's worth discussing here, because I think that this movie is and is considered a step forward in trans representation in like bigger, like critically acclaimed films, let's say. And then behind it, you have this movie wouldn't have been made if Mark Duplass hadn't gotten involved and if this guy, Sean Baker, hadn't directed it. So he made movies before. I think this was his first like big, really popular movie. And then he went on to, he also made The Florida Project.
Right.
But same writing team, same director. And
same font on the poster, even.
Same font.
Yeah.
I didn't even think
it's
of
true.
That. So, I mean, it's nothing. I mean, I don't know of anything negative about Sean Baker, but I do think that that is something that has come up on our show before, where sometimes in movies that are like pushing forward in some ways, you still have a lot of the old guard, let's say, behind the camera, which sucks. Like, you, I mean, ideally, there should be more Black directors being able to direct Black stories and trans directors being able to direct trans stories and not need, you know, have the perceived need for a white guy who went to NYU really involved at all. I think in this case, a beautiful movie was turned out by it. But that kind of gets into what we were talking about a bit at the top of the show, which is the writing process. And once you find out that like a Duplass brother is involved, the writing style kind of all comes together. You're like, oh, okay. So
both of them.
Yeah. You're like, okay, so this movie isn't necessarily, like, it's written and it's not written, because that's a very like Duplass brothers, they're the mumblecore kings, whatever. And it seems like this movie had a very similar approach to writing. So my understanding, based on just the production history and on interviews I read at the time that the movie was coming out, was that Sean Baker wasn't ingratiated in the communities he's portraying in these movies. He was just kind of a guy who made movies and was looking for stories to tell, and lived in West Hollywood, and so was aware of the sex worker community. He was aware of the trans community, but he, you know, obviously he didn't have any experience there himself, and so he started to talk with the two women who eventually starred in this movie, Ketana Kiki Rodriguez and Maya Taylor. And through, Caitlin, you were saying this earlier, but through talking with them, getting to know them, spending time with them, sort of discovered the story that seemed right to tell through talking with them. Mm-hmm. And like you were saying, a lot of the major plot points in this movie are based on the experiences that either they or their friends had had.
Right, because they are both former sex workers. Mm-hmm. They are both trans women. They like very much lived this experience that their characters are depicting in the movie, which on one hand, it's amazing that you have trans characters played by trans actors, which is unfortunately historically in Hollywood pretty rare.
Eddie Redmayne.
Right.
I feel like he still hasn't had to answer for that.
Oh, for the Danish girl?
Yeah.
And the fact that, yeah, I mean, they are Black trans women. They have this experience of being former sex workers. It's their kind of real life story that's being told through this movie that, again, was, as far as the credited writers go, is these two cis white men.
Yeah. It's a really long way of getting to the fact that Kiki and Maya should, based on everything I've read and seen about this movie, they should be credited as writers of this movie just as much, if not more so, than Sean Baker mm-hmm. and Chris Burgock?
Not sure how to say it.
Yeah.
Question mark.
Who's this Chris guy?
There's no Wikipedia link for him, so we may never know.
But this is also, in addition to, like, again, major plot points being lifted from their lived experiences.
Yeah.
I also read that a lot of the dialogue that was written into the script got basically altered, improvised, adapted. To be more authentic. Right. Yeah. So it was the actors sort of rewriting the dialogue.
I could tell that Chester's lines were 100% written by a straight cis white dude. Like that was written mm-hmm. on a fucking MacBook Pro. Those lines right there.
That's some final 100%. Draft shit going on.
Yeah.
It's true. And I feel like, yeah, when you know that going into watching the movie, the viewing experience is, it's still a wonderful movie, but it's a little different because mm-hmm. you can hear those written scenes in there, like under this like very authentic, like natural feeling dialogue mm-hmm. from Kiki and Maya. And I was also saying, reading and hearing in the interviews that they gave around this, that Kiki and Maya were also really instrumental in like constantly reminding Sean Baker and pushing to make the movie funny and to make it a romp. Mm-hmm. And
they're so funny. They're so naturally funny.
Yeah.
For sure.
Like their line readings were ridiculous.
Yeah, it's so hilarious.
So perfect.
And it seems like, and I think that a tendency a lot for white filmmakers telling non-white stories is to just, it's depressing and it's like framed as tragedy. And even though there are sad things that happen inside of this movie, it doesn't feel like a weighed down tragic story. And that sounds, based on all the interviews, it sounds like that is directly due to Kiki and Maya pushing for that. So I cannot find a reason other than Hollywood being an asshole that they're not credited as writers
right.
on this movie. So
to speak to that a little more, this is a quote from an article in The Guardian where it says, quote, "The filmmaker admitted that his approach would have been more downbeat and dramatic had Rodriguez not put her foot down." Mm-hmm. Looking back, he realized how right she was. She was asking for something that would present these characters to mainstream audiences in a pop culture way so that they could identify with them, end quote.
So then pay her for that. Like, it's just right. It's so annoying when people pull this shit and continue to pull this shit because, mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, it seems like they wrote more of the story than he did.
I know.
He's like, eventually I realized that, you know, she was kind of right about like how the story that she basically created should be told. You know, like she had good instincts, I guess.
And he's like, yeah, I'll put my name on that. Sure. You're just like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
It's so many things at once because I just like, ugh, it's frustrating because it's like, I'm not trying to suggest that Sean Baker is a bad person. And I think that he made a lovely movie, but it just doesn't seem like Kiki and Maya are adequately credited for the amount of influence and work that they did and had over this movie. So
yeah, the actors made it.
Totally. And yeah, especially because like a writing credit would have meant that they got more money. They would have been paid more and
yeah,
and things like that.
They could have been nominated for writing awards. Like they're another thing that this movie, I think, was like considered as like a milestone that Tangerine pushed forward was some of the first the Oscars suck. So, of course, they slept on it. But some of the first like acting nominations for trans women were because of this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, there is a lot of, if not first, some of the best in recent memory progress for representation. But it's still just the fact that at the end of the day, it is credited basically exclusively to white guys behind the camera is disappointing and frustrating. And it's like, I wish I could say I were surprised.
Well, I'm wondering how much anyone got paid on this, though, because
it was super
the budget
low
was $100,000.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
They shot it on 3 5S's.
Okay.
Right, iPhone 5S's, yeah.
And they edited it, and I think just like...
iMovie, probably? No.
No, it was super... I mean, it seems like they used equipment that they already had to make it. But even that aside, it's like they still have a whole crew. They have... There's a lot of performers in this movie, and you have to imagine they're not making a ton of money to do it. And... It's like, Mark Duplass, you have money.
Yeah, come on, Mark.
Sir. In any case,
Well, something that has been coming up for us a lot is we want to encourage people from all backgrounds to be inclusive in their writing. And we've been saying, again, this more often, more recently, but, you know, we're not saying that... a white cis man couldn't make a great movie about black trans sex workers, because we saw that they did. That did happen. Mm-hmm. And I have a quote here from another article entitled What Tangerine Taught Hollywood About How to Tell Trans Stories from the publication Them. Quote, to craft a story about a world with which they had little experience, director Sean Baker and his writing partner, Chris Berggach knew when to ask for help right away. The humility demonstrated by Baker and Berggach in copping to a lack of knowledge about their intended subject up front is essential for any cis filmmaker who wants to incorporate trans themes or characters into their work. I'll end the quote there, and we'll post this article because I think the whole thing is worth reading. But that's what we always say, like, do your homework. You can represent communities responsibly, even if you do not belong to that community. It is going to be much harder for you, and it will take a lot more homework. But I guess, and I don't want to sound like I'm giving these guys too much credit, but the bottom line is, yeah, definitely that, like, these two actors, the lead actors in this movie, should have been given far more credit in what they contributed creatively to the movie, way more than they were.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, if you're doing your homework, that is critical and important, but you also need to, like, give credit where credit is due. And that's not just in interviews. It is also something that you do financially, and it's something you do by, like, using your own influence to continue to, like, provide a platform and provide, like, it's just, Sean Baker is more on the right track than I think a lot of cis white guys are, but it's still the fact that I'm just like, they should have been paid more, they should have been credited more. And because like, this movie was nominated for a lot of behind the scenes stuff too, and they should have, you know, gotten a cut of that as well. So
What have they done after this?
Not too much, unfortunately. This is Kiki Rodriguez's only film credit. And Maya has been in a few other things, but mostly short films. And then she's in a movie called Stage Mother that came out this year that has Jackie Weaver and Lucy Liu and Adrienne Grenier. She's working, but Kiki isn't as much. And I feel like that's something too, is the fact that Sean Baker, you know, gets to kind of use Tangerine as a springboard and go on to make The Florida Project, a movie that I haven't seen it. I know it's well regarded, but a movie with a larger budget and a movie like he was able to leverage Tangerine into more opportunities for himself. But what mm-hmm. about the women whose story he was literally telling with Tangerine? And did they get left behind in an unfair way? And what, meanwhile, this white guy gets to use their experience, however well told, as a springboard for his own career.
Right.
Mm. Yuck.
Yuck.
This is a good time to cut to our next segment with another one of our special guests. She is a stand-up and improv comic, a dungeon master, and sometimes freestyle rapper. It's Violet Gray. Hello.
Hello. Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you for being here. So more or less, we just wanted to hear your thoughts specifically on the representation of Black trans women in the movie Tangerine.
Sure. So I was just telling my partner that my position on this has evolved quite a bit, because if you had asked me 15 years ago what I thought of the representation of Black trans women in the movie Tangerine, I would have talked about this uncomfortable consistency in portraying Black women and Black trans women as like drug addicted prostitutes. But since then, in the last 15 years or so, I've really evolved on what it means to be a sex worker and what it means to have addiction. And I would say there's nothing wrong, there's nothing shameful about being in the sex industry. And one thing I did like is that, I mean, there was a scene where they're using drugs, they're smoking crack. And it didn't happen until much later in the movie. And I thought that was good because it established them as humans first. They're not drug addicts, they're humans who do drugs. And it took them out of this archetype. I liked both the characters. I understood that that environment is some people's realities. I was thankful that they were humanized the way they did. I saw a lot in the movie that reminded me of myself. So there's a scene where Cindy is in the subway train and she's looking out of the window. I don't think a lot of people realize that if you're a trans person, that can be a sort of defense mechanism, because you're pretty much locked in a box with complete strangers for a while. And when you're looking out the window, they can't see your face and they can't see your features. So I guess that there's something to be said about how Black trans women are consistently portrayed. I do think there is a conversation there. But I also think that, hey, sex workers and people who have substance abuse issues are humans too. And I think ultimately this movie was more about friendship and adversity than any of that.
To speak to the, so I was just talking about how just last night at the time of this recording, this documentary just came out on Netflix, but the doc disclosure that Laverne Cox, among many other people, executive produced, they touch on this specific thing in the documentary about how the representation of Black trans women, especially in media, that they are depicted as sex workers pretty disproportionately. And there is an acknowledgement that there are statistically many Black trans women sex workers, but as the documentary disclosure points out, there's usually a failure in movies and television to examine why that might be, which is that the unemployment rate for Black trans women is very high because of discrimination. And many Black trans women have no choice but to turn to sex work because no one will give them a job. Yeah, there's always a failure to acknowledge any of the systemic reasons why Black trans women might be sex workers, and it's just like, well, that's just what Black trans women be. And yeah,
right, as if when everyone was going to elementary school and one person wanted to be a police officer and the other person wanted to be
right. Yeah.
No little kid is mm-hmm. in it. And when people want to know about intersectionality, mm-hmm. Black trans women are my go-to example, mm-hmm. because it is the intersection of being a person of color and being transgender, mm-hmm. as an example. But yes, I do think that a lot of people, especially people who push this personal responsibility narrative, as if it's a false dichotomy, it's an either or, you're either taking personal responsibility for your situation or you're blaming external factors, mm-hmm. as if external factors can't possibly be responsible, at least in part, for your current situation, mm-hmm. whatever that situation may be. But yes, I think what most minority groups need above anything else in film representation is to be humanized.
Right.
And I think that Tangerine did do a good job of that.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I'm also curious of, going off of Tangerine a little bit, what would you like to see more of in terms of representation? What is something that you would like to see more of that isn't quite, I don't know, that isn't quite in the mainstream yet?
As far as Black trans women?
Yes.
Or
yes.
Just in general? Oh, as far as Black, okay. So one of my favorite sci-fi books, and one of the stories that I point to as one of the best representation of a trans person, is a book called The Fifth Season, by N.K. Jemisin. And there's a trans character in there who you don't find out is trans until 2/3 of the way through the book. But until then, mostly what you know about her is that she's this sort of terminally curious mad scientist. She sees a new thing and she's like, how does that work? I wonder what the technical applications of this are. Maybe if we put this thing in it, we could do this thing. And she comes from a well-to-do family, but she is pretty much exiled, not just because she's trans, but because she was supposed to be the man of the house who was supposed to marry well. And she's like, well, I can't do that because I'm a woman. I can't be what you need me to be. And so I really liked a story where a trans person, her transness is not her defining trait, but at the same time, it doesn't pretend that it doesn't exist.
Sure.
Right.
So when you're saying like, what would I like to see more of? I would like to see more things like that. Acknowledging someone's transness without it being the defining trait.
For sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a balance that it seems like Hollywood, at least even though slow and slight progress is being made in terms of trans representation in Hollywood, it seems like still so many of the stories or storylines in shows or whatever are still very much contingent on, well, this is a trans person and that's the thing we know about them.
Right.
Yes, there was a controversy about a video game. I believe it was one of the Baldur's Gate or Icewind Dale games.
Oh, okay.
And there was a trans character and it got criticized for poor representation because the trans person disclosed their transness, their trans status. They mention it in like the opening sentence of meeting the character, the main character. So it would be the equivalent of going up to someone. It's like, hi, Caitlin, nice to meet you. I'm trans. So anyway,
that's so jarring. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And so they were like, you know, yes, there is something to be said for, it's evolving is the point that I'm getting at. And so you have trans characters in games now that aren't so in your face, but it's like, do you remember Atari?
Yeah.
Yes.
You remember how it was originally blocks and now the PlayStation 5 is coming out and it looks damn near like real people?
Right.
Yeah.
I think dialogues have sort of the same progression.
I like this metaphor.
I know. It's like, this is good shit.
Yeah. I think that they're still figuring out and me being having gothic tendencies, I don't usually lean toward optimism, but I think that they're working it out.
Yeah. And that's a lot of what that documentary Disclosure is about, this sort of slow evolution of trans representation in media, and how for decades and decades it was all about transphobia, trans panic, just all of the really harmful things that misrepresentation of trans people does for individuals as well as culture at large, and how it's really only been in the past like maybe 5 years that there's been any kind of headway made in terms of progress towards more empathetic and positive representations of trans people in popular media.
I think that once the internet came out, once we had the internet, it was a wrap, because knowledge is the bane of ignorance. And now with the internet, we can just know things at such a rapid pace. A lot of people can know a thing very quickly. And so I don't really think that there would be a discussion of intersectional feminism at this rate, or Black Lives Matter, or trans issues without the information age that we now live in.
Totally.
And we would, I mean, what we were talking about in the episode was it seems like Tangerine is a good step in the right direction, but I hope in a couple of years we're at a point where it's like a sci-fi story with a trans protagonist. That would be fucking incredible.
Right, and absolutely.
Like, just like you were saying, just, you know, centering the story on a trans character in a way that isn't like, and this is what trans representation is. It's like, no, we're in a sci-fi world with a trans character.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah. The normalization is still something we need to normalize, if that makes any sense.
Yes.
Wow, put it on a t-shirt. Wow. Really makes you think.
I mean, it's a process, but it's something we'll just have to keep working on until we do it. Because I remember watching a documentary on the representation of Black people on the screen back when they were Black and white movies. And there was a time when if a Black person was on the screen for a couple of seconds, Black families would call out to everyone in the house and say, look, a Black person on TV. And they would all run to the TV to watch the Black person on TV. And this was before, say, Living Single or The Cosby Show or What's Happening or Family Matters. And so, yeah, I think most groups probably, when it comes to representation, go through this process.
As we talk about on the show often, representation will kind of come in waves, or there will be stages to it where, first of all, any marginalized group will be more or less just erased, pretend that they don't exist in media.
Absolutely.
Then there will be an acknowledgement of their existence and an inclusion of it on screen, but that representation will be horrifying, racist, transphobic, you know, all, just like really damaging. And then when you know, enough people realize that that's not good, then there will be more progress to something. And then that's when
Tangerine even is like that very particular sub step that we've noticed, where it's like, okay, we are going to center this story on Black trans women in an authentic way. The director is still some random white guy who went to NYU, but you know, it's like the story is still not like given to the people who need to be telling it.
Yes.
So it's like a step, like inching forward.
Yeah. A lot of people don't know that the writers for Good Times were all white.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
To didn't begin with.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that is definitely a process that it was the source of some tension between the actors and the writers sometimes.
I'd imagine so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. But yeah, it is part of the evolution, something that I think most of us believe in.
Yes.
Yes.
But yes, Aikid. But yeah, I do think it is one of the things that is part of the normal process. The no representation, then really bad representation.
And then small stepping stones. And then someday, hopefully very soon, we have just no one could take any issues with the representation that we see, because mm-hmm. it's at a place where it's positive and good. And yeah,
a sci-fi expanded universe.
Right. And that will yeah. come with trans people being the ones to tell their own stories.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I look forward to the day when the country can hate a trans villain because she's a douche.
Right. And not, yeah. And not because she's like a weird, tropey
right.
murderer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any other thoughts, any other things you'd like to share in terms of Tangerine specifically or representation in general?
One thing that I thought was particularly poignant about Tangerine, mm-hmm. and I think this is true of many minority groups, but I think trans women and trans women of color in particular, mm-hmm. is so toward the very end, she found out that her best friend cheated with her boyfriend, mm-hmm. and she was like too angry to be angry. Mm-hmm. Too angry to be angry, right. and she's trying to walk away, and then she's a victim of this hate crime.
Yeah.
And then Alexandra takes her to the laundromat to get cleaned up and mm-hmm. gives her her wig, which is, wow, mm-hmm. which is a major gesture. Mm-hmm. And one thing I thought was very poignant was about how, to some extent, marginalized people have this bond because they have to, mm-hmm. because at the end of the day, the rest of the world is against marginalized people. Mm-hmm. And I thought that it ended on a note that expressed the value of sticking together and being there for each other.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Well, Violet, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us.
This was wonderful.
Thank you so much for having me. It was so much fun.
Yes. Give us your plugs, your social media handles. Where can people follow you?
Find your work.
Oh, sure. On Instagram, I'm Chaotic Violet. You get to see all my weird Renaissance fair costumes.
Oh, nice.
And on Twitter, I'm Violet Silver. Mm-hmm. And this Monday, I'm going to be on the Butter Boy comedy Zoom show.
Yeah.
I love
with Aparna Nancherla, Ron Funches, awesome. Judah Friedlander.
Amazing.
Yeah. That is where you can find me. Oh, Violet Gray on YouTube. Mm. And yeah, that's it.
Incredible.
Amazing.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Yes.
Wonderful.
Yay. Let's take a quick break and then we'll be back for more.
There's nothing worse than wearing clothes that don't fit right. That's why Tomboy X makes size and gender-inclusive underwear, swimwear, and loungewear for all bodies. Queer-founded and run for over 10 years, you can trust they know a thing or two about making the perfect pair. Feel comfortable in your own skin. Shop online today and use code IHEART for 20% off your first purchase. Only at TomboyX.com. Tomboy X. Fit for you just as you are.
Tired of restless nights? Meet Lisa, the sleep experts. Here at Lisa, we know that good sleep is essential for mental, physical, and emotional health. That's why their mattresses are made for exceptional comfort and support, catering to every sleep need. Check out Lisa's Sapira Hybrid Mattress, named Best Hybrid Mattress 5 years running. Sleep hot? The Chill Collection is built with cool-to-the-touch top fabric and layers of high-density comfort foams, all intended to remove excess body heat while maximizing comfort. With Lisa, getting a new mattress has never been easier. Delivery is free, and you have 100 nights to try out your mattress in the comfort of your home. Don't spend another night dreaming of better sleep. For a limited time, save up to $700 off select mattresses plus 2 free pillows. Go to lisa.com/iHeart for an additional $50 off mattresses and select goods. That's LEESA.com/iHeart. Exclusions apply. See lisa.com for more details.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. When Dr. Sabah and I decided to do a skincare line together, he said to me, we are going to give women meaningful beauty. And I said, that's exactly right. We want to give women meaningful beauty, which means each and every product is meaningful. It has a reason to exist. It's efficacious. You're going to get results. And then you just go out and live your life.
Meaningful beauty. Confidence is beautiful. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
We're back. And
another thing that I love how this movie like toes the line of you so often see like characters defined by their own trauma. Like, I think that that's a lot of like when cishet white guys are writing outside of their own experience, and when like a lot of like when any writer is writing outside of their own experience, I feel like it is a really lazy writing tactic to lean on defining someone by their trauma. And I think this movie for the most part toes the line really well of portraying that like there are very, very real struggles that these characters are encountering. We find out that Cindy was just put in jail, it seems like for not a good reason. The kind of looming presence of the cops that never fully explodes but is always there. Like, you see the unfair shit that they have to deal with, but it doesn't dominate the story in a way that defines them. What defines the story is how, you know, it is primarily like Alexandra and Cindy's friendship, which is so like fun to see, and that's a whole journey as well. And yeah,
for sure. It's also, I mean, the characters themselves, many of them are not, I guess for lack of a better term, woke. Like, there's
what?
There's slurs that I know. There's, you know, there's reductive and offensive name calling that gets thrown around. There's, I mean, a large component of the story is Cindy being pretty violent toward another woman and not holding Chester accountable enough, perhaps, for cheating and really in targeting the other woman, you know, which is a thing that always, you know, dings our little bell. But at the same time, like, I give all of that a pass, just because, again, that these characters feel so, I'm like, yes, that would probably happen. And of course this,
and Dinah is such an Dinah, I mean, and she has her own like sub story as well, but like when you meet Dinah, she's such an antagonistic asshole. Like, you know, it doesn't necessarily justify the violence against her, but I also, it's like, I don't know, Cindy is already upset. Dinah does not approach the situation in a way that is remotely like cool or calm or anything, and so I feel like it's justified in story of like, you know, particularly when you first meet her, before you get those like more tender moments and you get more context for her, you're like, oh, I get why Cindy is like pissed at this lady.
But also, as shitty as all the men are in the movie, the cis men, you never really get the feeling that any of the women are actually threatened by them.
Mm.
Though in real life, that might not be the case. In the film, you don't get that impression.
Right.
That's true. I guess, yeah, with Alexandra's client early on, where he only has $40 and he's like trying to shortchange her, and like she has none of it, and it ends up like it the situation flares up, but eventually it's fine and she has control of the situation. She gets her $40, right? At least, I forget.
I don't think she ever does.
Does she not?
I think she did,
because
the
cops interfere.
Oh, right. Ugh, fuck.
Yeah. But then she does meet up with Razmik, who gives her money. But Razmik is also...
it's complicated.
Yeah, but that's, I mean, right. And then also, like, I wanted to mention that even though Cindy is literally dragging Dinah by her hair and being violent toward her and all this stuff, I can't speak from personal experience, but I have to imagine that she, as a Black trans woman, would feel very betrayed by Chester cheating on her with a cis white woman. And I'm like, oh yeah, I get it. Like, I'm not necessarily pro her hitting Dinah, but I don't know. I am.
Yeah, I totally was.
Yeah.
If anyone's going to do it, it should be her. you know?
Right.
Right, right.
It feels like it's not really abusive.
Yeah, she's just she was betrayed and
they were having fun. It looked like they were having fun.
They smoke meth together. Yeah. It's fine.
It is. It's like
it's different rules.
It's so funny because it's like not to excuse a kidnapping, but it seems like a pretty light kidnapping because by the time they're on the bus, like even Dinah is kind of like joking about it. She's like, "Oh, can I pick up my hair tie? Is that okay? I'm still your captive, but like, can I put my hair back?" And Cindy's like, "Yeah, fine, whatever." And it's like, "Oh, okay. This is a very friendly kidnapping. They go to a show together. They, you know, it's right. Yeah.
When they went to the bar and the door guy said she's only got one shoe. She said she's from the hills. She's a hillbilly. She's that's a
hill. And the door guy's just like, sure, fine, whatever, right. Great.
Yeah, I mean, I keep having to remind myself that like these are people whose survival instinct and just like survival mentality is so much more heightened than mine needs to be because of my privilege. Like, I don't need to be out on the streets where the risk of danger and violence against me is much greater. So I have to like remind myself, like, while I wouldn't drag another woman out onto the street by her hair, like, I am not put in danger every day.
Also, the stakes are a little higher when you consider that going back to jail for either of these women most likely means being put in a jail with men.
Right. Very true.
Absolutely. I think that, yeah, and the fact that even though they're not credited as writing it, the fact that Maya and Kiki are writing this story from their own experiences, you know, they're presenting true experiences and they're presenting it in a way that is very fun to watch. And
I mean, yeah, that's why the movie's good. Yeah. Like it's so because of them and their performances and their input and their lived experiences that get adapted to the screen. Like, yeah, that's why this movie was a success.
And it's like, let's be honest, if we had just let Sean and Chris,
it would be so depressing.
Ugh, like, yeah, guess their way around what the relationship between Cindy and Dinah would be. They would have gotten it so wrong. Like,
it would have been Requiem for a Dream with a song.
Exactly. Like, it would have just, and so, yeah, I, everything in this movie that it just, that you're just like, oh, I don't, is, but it's like, it's they're telling their own story in an authentic way and it's based on true experiences. And it's just like, okay, that it is what it is. Like they're telling their story.
Mm-hmm. Now is a good time to cut to our next segment with another special guest. She is a comedian, a writer for the Portland Mercury. She's an associate producer of the Portland Queer Comedy Festival. It's Dahlia Bell.
Yay! Hi.
Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Of course. So we just wanted to hear your thoughts on the representation of Black trans women in the movie Tangerine specifically, and then if you had any other thoughts on trans representation, Black trans representation, the intersection of those things in media in general.
Yeah, so to be entirely honest, I did have to go back and watch the movie about two nights ago. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it did not rub me well. I will say that. And I really had to do some personal soul searching.
Sure.
Because, you know, initially I'm like, am I so puritanical or am I so caught up in respectability that I'm opposed to the representation of Black trans women as sex workers? And I thought about that and no, I'm absolutely not. Mm. And quite honestly, many of my friends are full service sex workers. So I'm like, no, that's not my issue. Is it even necessarily the drug use? I would say no. I do understand where drug use does play a role in both trans culture and the broader queer culture, simply you know, being stuck in situations where we're trying to find ourselves. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, I've been a pro-drug advocate. Mm-hmm. However, the representation I feel is very sloppy and relies on some very familiar tropes. Mm-hmm. That I think, generally speaking, representations of mm-hmm. trans women are guilty of. For example, the image of... Mm-hmm. So first, I do want to commend the movie for mm-hmm. casting what I would say are realistic, average-looking mm-hmm. trans women, as opposed to even a program I love like Pose, where you have the obviously over-glamorized mythos sure. that people want to see. Mm-hmm. But all the same, I feel sure. it's a very messy image mm-hmm. of trans sex workers. It kind of paints mm-hmm. us as buffoons, mm. sort of the old step and fetch it tradition.
Okay. Yeah.
Then the trope of, you know, fighting over the affection of some ne'er-do-well cis male. Uh-huh. You know, yeah, exactly. Like, why is that always our ultimate prize? You know, like, mm-hmm.
Chester.
Surely there's nothing else that trans women could possibly want than some random cis loser.
And that is putting it nicely, honestly. Like, Chester, Chester sucks.
Absolutely. Yeah, he's garbage. So, yeah. I mean, I speak 100%. Only for myself. But honestly, I think I speak for a lot of especially contemporary trans women when I say many of us do ultimately embrace what appears to be exclusively lesbian lifestyles or ways of being or identities mm-hmm. because our experiences with cis men are so negative. Mm-hmm. And at a certain point, you have to be like, is this worth my time? Mm-hmm. Is this something worth chasing after? And that's a question that's never really raised in any depiction of trans women that I have ever seen. Yeah. There's always sure. this element of us longing for the affection of this class. I don't know why.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally see your point. Mm. I've seen this movie a few times now. I love it. I think it's such a fun... Yeah. Romp. And of course, I'm coming at it, you know, Jamie and I are coming at it with blind spots with our backgrounds. So yeah, to say I hadn't even fully considered your point about the kind of buffoonery that is arguably displayed. I always yeah. sort of interpreted that as, oh, but they're fun and they're just, you know, they're goofy. And we're seeing, like, rather than a tragic story, which is how many trans narratives play out, we're seeing a fun romp. So that was, like, always my kind of, like, right. you know, just interpretation of that.
Yeah.
But I totally see your point.
And I had to look at that, you know, yeah. numerous times, because is it inherently buffoonery to have trans performers in, you know, slapstick sort of roles? Mm. And to make that argument would be very problematic as well. Mm. But I think for me, it's a matter of looking at that intersection of Black heritage mm-hmm. and Black history within American cinema, and then trans representation. And when you really look at the Venn diagram of that,
yeah.
I think there are some issues raised, uh-huh. you know?
We've been talking a lot about how, I mean, the fact that the movie is written and directed by cis white guys as well. Likely, you know, factors into a lot of what's going on within the movie that maybe doesn't match up quite well, and how the yeah. two lead actresses in this movie were not credited as writers, even though they had a
yeah.
huge influence on what happened in the story. And then
yeah.
ultimately all the credit going back to, you know, the Tisch grad is exhausting.
So that was the first time you had seen it. Is that right? Is that what?
Yeah. Yeah, oh, okay. And it was interesting because my partner, who's also non-binary trans, mm-hmm. they're gender fluid mm-hmm. though, but it was their second or third time seeing it. Mm-hmm. And they're more a fan of, like, queer cinema.
Uh-huh.
So they've been like taking me on this tour of of all the queer classics.
Sure.
And, you know, kind of realizing some holes and blind spots in a lot of the films that a lot of us felt were mm-hmm. formative, you know, just because at that time, the people that were in the writing room weren't necessarily part of our community, or even the people in the writing rooms who are part of the community are likely those who fit into a specific narrative.
That makes a ton of sense. We hadn't even come at it from that angle. That makes a ton of sense. Is there any, I mean, not to, we don't want to put you on the spot, but what would you like to see more from in terms of trans representation in film in general and Black trans representation?
Yeah, I guess what I would really like to see would be, I guess, the happy medium,
mm-hmm.
you know, the happy medium, even if we're going to be represented exclusively as sex workers. You know, I get why that trope is still useful. but even if we're going to do that, I would like it to be maybe a happy medium between, say, Tangerine and Pose, where you have mm-hmm. these realistic, average-looking, perhaps quote-unquote non-passable trans mm-hmm. sex workers who are empowered, not necessarily wealthy, not necessarily glamorous, but not being exploited or, you know, being reckless or mm-hmm. things of this sort, but actually flourishing, thriving, maybe a montage sort of show where maybe you have the trans call girl and then you have the trans businesswoman and, you know, the trans whatever this dude does. He's a tailor maybe, but, you know, just allow us to be human beings
mm-hmm.
and not mm-hmm. just the sort of trope, either for cheap laughs or otherwise gratuity
yeah.
or sexualization, things of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And as we've been discussing, you know, representation is often, unless it's representation of like cishet white wealthy men, who there's an abundance of representation for in
yeah.
cinema. You know, we talk about how there's an evolution in terms of representation. It goes from erasure to negative representation to steps in the right direction
mm-hmm.
to positive representation. And it feels like we're still somewhere in the steps in the right direction phase in terms of trans representation in film and TV. And Tangerine feels to me like a good step in the right direction.
Yeah.
But maybe not what we want to see ideally, especially because the people behind the camera and taking credit for writing the script and things like that are white cis men telling the story of Black trans women.
Yeah.
I don't know. Would you agree with that assessment that, you know, Tangerine's a step in the right direction?
I think it will definitely be included in the canon long term. Mm-hmm. You know, I think mm-hmm. Tyler Perry still has his place within Black cinema. That doesn't mm-hmm. mean I'm going to necessarily watch a Tyler Perry movie on purpose.
Madea isn't your favorite character?
Yeah, yeah. You see, you have to spring Tyler Perry on someone. You have to be like...
You have to walk in the room and it's already been on for 45 minutes and you're like, all right.
Yeah, exactly.
I guess we're
hey, what are we watching? Is this...
It's too late.
Any other thoughts you'd like to share?
No, I try to keep most of my thoughts to myself. It helps me keep friends.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank
this
you.
Has been so wonderful.
Thank you.
Give us your plugs. Where can people follow you online? Anything you'd like to plug?
Yeah. I'm going to behave. I think one of the more fun places to follow me is on Instagram at mix.daliabell, mix being MX. Dahlia Bell. You could also follow me on Facebook at Dahlia DeLue Bell or Mix Dahlia Bell. One is my comedy page. which kind of mirrors my Instagram. This is way too long of an explanation.
Keep going. We want to hear. We want to follow you doing everywhere.
Okay, if you follow my personal Facebook page, it's mostly my random political rantings and existential dread that I experience every morning around 2 a.m.
Of course.
But my Instagram are really cute pictures of me. So that's really where you should go.
What a great balance, though.
Depending on the vibes that you're seeking, there's a lot of options.
There's always Dahlia Bell.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much again.
Thank you. You are wonderful.
Have a good Sunday.
Yay. Thanks again, Dahlia. And now we're back with Kai Choice. Does anyone have any other thoughts, feelings?
Feelings.
Yeah, talk to us about your feelings, Kai.
So I just think everyone should know that if you got to go to Donut Time, you're very lucky. They actually have really good donuts there. But it later became a Trejos Tacos, and then it became a Trejos Donuts. Mm. And now it might be nothing soon. I don't know. I don't think it's doing very well.
Oh, no.
I could be wrong, but I don't see people there ever.
I haven't either. I know. I passed there a couple of days ago knowing that we were going to watch this movie. I was like, oh, goddamn, 7 years. 7 years makes all the difference.
I feel like a lot of stories that portray sex work tend to use that portrayal to remove agency from the characters and to kind of denigrate the experience. Mm. And you don't see that happening here.
Right.
Like, in every situation, the women seem to be very in control of the situation, regardless of whether or not that is always the case in real life.
For sure.
With these characters, like even with Razmik, you don't feel like he's exploiting these women.
Mm-hmm.
And the one guy who is trying to exploit someone ends up, you know,
getting the shit kicked out of
backfiring on him.
Yeah, right. So, which is
for sure
karma, baby. yeah, and that the story. I mean, the story covers a lot of ground, but every character gets a full arc, and the strongest bond in the movie is the bond between Cindy and Alexandra. And like, it's really fun to see. Especially like a female friendship that you see have ups and downs, and it's not just like a perfectly written, like, we're best friends, we always get along, everything's great, la la la. It's like they disagree with each other every other second, but there is such a clear bond. Maya and Kiki have such strong chemistry as performers that it just holds the movie together in such an amazing way that I cannot picture two different performers in this movie. Like, they make the movie.
I mean, they're like good friends in real life too. Yes.
Yeah, before they were cast. Yep.
Yeah, I feel like the iPhones got more airtime than they needed to in this. Like, people talked about the iPhones more than they talked about Maya and Kiki. Is we gotta turn that around.
Mm-hmm. Another thing kind of to piggyback on what you were saying just a moment ago, Kai, is the way sex work is often portrayed in movies and media. Another thing it will do, I think, is
it's like a plot device. It's treated as like a plot device that a character needs to overcome.
Right. That you know, a life that the characters are trying desperately to escape from, and maybe some of them are, but that isn't really a component of this movie, at least not on the day that we see these characters.
Yeah.
But then another thing is, like, I think that sex workers will often be characterized in such a way that they are shown as having like no moral compass almost, or they wouldn't care, like sex means nothing to them, or they can't form real human relationships, so they would never have a fiance or a boyfriend or, you know, anything like that. But like Cindy, this whole movie is driven by her envy, basically, of having been cheated on. Just another thing that humanizes these characters. And this movie also does a thing that's kind of subtle, but every so often we'll hear some of the sex worker characters tell a story like from their childhood. Like, there's one little anecdote where Alexandra is like, oh, I had a Barney doll and then I put it in the bathtub. And then I think maybe she's like the madame of the party room, but she says something like, yeah, me and my sister would always like go.
I would not describe that woman as a madame.
Is that what it says on her LinkedIn? Like, I'm party a madame room, of madame. The party room.
I like it.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what the best terminology is, but
no, I love the embellished credits.
It's great. It's fancy.
She says something like, yeah, me and my sister would go to these dances when we were kids and we were supposed to bring a boy, but I could never find a boy, so I had to go dance with my sister. And it was just like stories of them, like, and it's like, yes, like sex workers used to be children. They have interiority, they have feelings, they have jealousy, they have other, like, the whole range of emotions.
That's a trick, right? That's a trick they say if you're ever kidnapped by a serial killer, you should tell them a story involving your childhood, because it's the best way to humanize yourself to a complete stranger. It's because everyone can relate to being a kid. Supposedly, it works much better than screaming, let me go.
So in this case, the movie is the kidnapped and we are the serial killers.
Yes.
it's true, though. I feel like a common misstep in movies in general is just when you're trying to subvert a narrative, the message is more like, I'm not like the other girls, I'm like this. But what this movie does is just say, these are these characters, they're like this. The movie is not comparing them to other people. They're just showing, this is a night in the life of these characters. Like,
right.
Take it or leave it. And it seems like everyone wanted to take it. My cat is meowing.
Is someone's
so loud.
Cat?
Oh. She's so cute.
I know.
Oh, Flea.
I wanted to really quickly touch on Razmik and his family. Razmik is not the central character of the movie, obviously, but I did want to just bring up, because he is an Armenian immigrant who moved to Los Angeles. There is a large Armenian population in Los Angeles, but you never see them represented. And I did a little bit of research on this because, I mean, you do get that this movie does such a great job of giving every character like an interior life. And so for Razmik, he's dealing with his mother-in-law. You know, he's perhaps misrepresenting how he spends his time to his family. We're not exactly sure. But we see that he has a home life. We see that he has his own interior struggles. And that is not something that is usually lent to an Armenian character, because Armenian characters, I did a little research just to kind of confirm. I was like, I don't know how many Armenian characters I've seen in pop culture, really, at all. And representation for Armenian people, Kardashians aside, is extremely low. Most of the examples you'll find are on TV, and they're usually characterized rather violently. You'll see Armenian characters often pop up on like shows like The Sopranos as like mob bosses or things like that. There's definitely some stock characters. When Armenian characters appear on screen, they appear in a very particular way. And so, you know, again, Razmik and his family are not the center of the movie, but I do think it's, like many things this movie does, it is a step in the right direction. Because, I mean, in movies about LA in general, you are seeing one zip code in a gigantic city. Like, you're seeing
Beverly Hills, usually, yeah.
The class warfare zip code. And it is a gigantic, and many parts of it are wonderful and cool, but you don't get to see most of those parts. And so I thought it was really nice to see an Armenian family represented, and I sincerely hope that that continues to happen moving forward, and we get to see all sorts of Armenian characters. I would have loved to see more of Razmik's wife.
His wife.
No, she does have a name. Her name is Yeva. But yeah. I would have loved to see more of her. And like, so yeah, that's a yet another thing that this movie does that most movies about Los Angeles do not.
I agree. And to our Armenian listeners, if you have any other examples of positive representation you have seen on screen of Armenian people, let us know, because we'd like to check those out.
Yeah, and refer us to works and characters that are worth covering. We're always listening. But yeah, there have been some pieces written in the past several years about how extremely limited. There's one character on The Sopranos. There's a series of characters on The Shield.
Okay.
There's a character on Weeds. And then there's the Kardashians. Mm. End of list.
Yeah.
So we do need more Armenian representation as well.
Certainly. Yes. Does Tangerine pass the Bechdel test?
For sure.
Lots and lots.
Between all sorts of pairings of characters.
And again, the main, like we've said, the relationship that's really at the core of this movie is the friendship between Cindy and Alexandra. And they talk all the time about, and sure, they're talking about Chester sometimes, but Chester. Other times they're talking about fish. They're talking about Dinah. They're talking about, like, Alexandra's performance and singing and, you know, all kinds of stuff.
Dinah and Cindy talk at length as well. Mm-hmm. There is conversation between Resmik's wife and her mother that is usually concerning him, but there are a few line exchanges that don't, and they concern their daughter. And there's a lot of... This movie passes a whole bunch.
For sure.
All that to say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also, another rare example of a movie that passes the Vito Russo test, passes the
What's
DuVernay
that?
Test. The Vito Russo test, it basically examines if there are any queer characters in the movie at all, and if removing them would impact the plot at all.
Mm.
Basically, they have to be essential to the story, and they cannot only be identified by their queerness. They have to have, like, other characteristics and interiority. So,
okay.
This movie very handily passes that test. Like I said, the DuVernay test. Kind of all of them. It really hits all the marks. As far as our nipple scale goes, 0 to 5 nipples based on its representation of women. And also, part of me wants to kind of retool our nipple scale a bit, I know, but I think it would behoove us to kind of just reword it or like retool it a bit to it being more about like, how does this movie fare from an intersectional feminist point of view?
Totally. Yeah, that makes
sense.
So
either way, looking at it from either version of our nipple scale, it gets pretty top marks. I think I'm going to give it a 4.5. Mm. The fact that it is what I think is a good step in the right direction of trans representation, Black trans representation specifically. Also, we didn't really talk about this, but Cindy is Afro-Latina, which is another representation we often don't get in media in general. So I appreciated that aspect of her character as well. Yeah, I think that it handles a lot of things very well. As we've discussed, the humanization of sex workers and sex work and the focus on the friendship between Cindy and Alexandra and the fact that a story about Black trans sex workers is fodder for like tragedy porn. And that's not what this movie was at all.
This
it was a fun
many
romp.
Genres in one. Yeah.
I loved all those things. I love this movie. I'm going to watch it every Christmas. And
fuck Die
also,
Hard. This is the Christmas movie.
Right.
Boom.
Yeah. So where it gets taken off for me is, again, this idea of, well, the only way we're going to be allowed to learn about trans people or hear their stories is through the lens of cis white men at this moment in history. You know, this should have been a movie made by trans filmmakers. So,
A step.
So yeah, 4.5, and I'll split my nipples between Cindy and Alexandra.
Cool. Yeah, I was going to go, I think a 4.25 on this movie. I feel weird marking it much higher because while this movie has so many wonderful elements going for it in terms of representation, I do still feel like I always get a bit of like a when you look up the director and you find out, mm-hmm. okay, this is, and something that bugs me that we discussed a little bit as well is that the director goes on to leverage the success of this movie into making mm-hmm. The Florida Project, another wonderful movie that does not involve any of the cast from Tangerine. And we haven't seen really many actors from this movie since, even mm-hmm. in that same director's work. And I do feel like, particularly if you are an NYU guy who, and I'm not saying that, you know, he didn't do a great job. I think he did. But I mm-hmm. do feel like you cannot, in good faith, use to some extent a marginalized community story to launch your own career and then not prioritize lifting everyone with you. Like, that is just
right.
You can't. Other than that, I do agree with everything you said, Caitlin. I love the representation of Black trans women. I love the friendship. I love that it's a romp. It's so funny. And I credit, you know, 90% of it to the lead actresses. They're so good. And also, you know, you get a representation of just a lot of Los Angeles that you normally wouldn't. You have the picture of an Armenian immigrant family. You have, there, you know, sex worker representation. Mm-hmm. This movie's got everything. I'll go 4.25. Yeah. I'll give 2 to Cindy, 2 to Alexandra, and 1/4 to Resmeek's baby.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Resmeek's dog, but that's probably better. I would have given it to the dog.
I mean,
but that's just me.
We're different people.
Yes. Kai, how about you?
I want to say a 4, and mm-hmm. I would say the only reason I'm not giving it a 5 is because of the issues that you guys brought up, but also because there was a little bit of a Tarantinoism going on here, where I think that anytime you have white characters using the N-word to display how terrible of a person they are, it should at least, there should be a Black person directing it or writing it or something, because by all appearances, they got that pass from whoever wrote the script.
True.
Which was not necessary. They were terrible enough as it went.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Totally.
You could replace the N-word with a Monster energy drink in the hand and, you know, we get the same impression.
And we get it.
Yeah.
Well, Kai, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah,
thanks for
you.
Having me. This was fun.
It's nice to talk to you.
Yeah, good to see you. It's been a while.
Likewise.
Where can people follow your stuff, check out your podcast?
You guys can listen to my podcast anywhere podcasts are found. It's called Women Who Kill. It is a true crime comedy podcast, and the focus of each episode is a lady who is a murderer. So we don't talk about any dudes who rape and murder unless they're part of a couple. which it's only happened a couple of times. You can also find me on Twitter and Instagram at Kai Choice. That's KAICHOYCE. And I mean, that's about it. We're not doing live shows these days. Maybe one day we'll be back to it. But otherwise, you can catch me on podcasts. You can catch me being highly inappropriate on social media.
I really thoroughly enjoy your social media presence, if I may say.
Thank you.
Speaking of social media, you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Bechdelcast. We've got a Patreon, aka Matreon. It's $5 a month. It gets you 2 bonus episodes plus our entire back catalog of all of our bonus episodes. And
you guys got to start using Protagonista, by the way.
Protagonista.
Yeah, I'll give you that.
It's in.
You can have it.
Thanks for tuning in. See you next time.
Bye.
Is your underwear in need of a refresh? Meet Tomboy X, makers of the original boxer briefs for women, queer-founded and queer-run. Tomboy X designs sustainable, gender-inclusive underwear and apparel in sizes 3 extra small to 6 extra large. Use code IHEART at checkout for 20% off your first purchase only at TomboyX.com. Shop now on TomboyX.com.
Turns out, a delightfully clean home can make for a delightful start to the day.
At Mrs. Meyers, everything they make is inspired by the garden. With plant-derived and other thoughtfully chosen ingredients, their cleaning products smell like a dream and work like the Dickens, leaving your home sparkly clean and your to-do list tackled in no time. Goodness, there's no better feeling than that. Mrs. Meyers, rooted in goodness. Visit MrsMeyers.com today.
Hey guys, back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah. And some waves. So we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that.
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in.
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it.
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby.
Wait. Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.